I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Money Matters with MeQ. Today, we continue our conversation with Adrian Johnson about saving and how to move from being a saver to an investor. Adrian Johnson, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark. Good seeing you again.
So we talked about savings last week and how important it is to get that ball rolling. But this is a very tough time. This recession we've just faced has reduced a lot of people's retirement funds. And we keep hearing about put your money in the stock market. But quite frankly, I don't trust the stock market. A lot of people don't trust the stock market place to put your money. So what's your approach about saving for retirement, which is not an easy thing to do?
Well, you have to save for retirement.
And we remember from last week, you're the big saver. You started out as a little kid taking that dime out of that dollar.
This is true. But you think about it as you get older, you have to simultaneously save or think about retirement. And so some of those funds that you're setting aside, you have to be allocated to retirement. And a lot of times companies today, they offer 401ks or 403bs or whatever it is, retirement savings, or you have to go out and do it on your own. But as I said last week, you got to start that layer of savings. And so that rainy day fund and that emergency fund, the whole goal of all of this is financial independence. And so you have to start small and build that cushion up so you're able to do some of the things that you want to do. But retirement is very, very important. You mentioned the stock market. Just to kind of give you some facts, last year this time, if you look at March of 2009, stock market was around 6750. Today it's around 11,000.
What do you mean 6750, 11,000?
The numbers are 6,750, 6,700. And so it has grown from that number up to around 11,000 here in May of 2010. And what that means is you can see that the stock market has grown. It peaked in October of 2007, 14,000 was the number of the Dow. And so we have a lot of room to grow into 14,000. And so for folks that are fearful, the stock market has outperformed any other investment. And so over time. And so you have to be in there.
You have to be in there.
Yeah. If you want your money to grow, if you want to outpace inflation, you're going to have to make that choice.
But a lot of people are investing through their 401ks at work.
Yes.
And those have lost a lot of money
Yes.
for a lot of people.
Yes.
And not everyone has that. So for a person to do their own investing and start planning their own retirement, and let's say you're in your 20s or 30s, so how do they approach this? What's the best way to think about this? Because many people have argued to me that just investing all your money in the stock market is a mistake.
Right. Well, you want to have diversification. And so you have to have goals. You have to have a certain risk tolerance. What is my risk tolerance? How much risk am I willing to take? Well, you look at the horizon that's out there of all the investment options and alternatives, and you find out that you're going to have some of your money if you're, and it all depends on, how far away do I have to go to retirement? And so what I would suggest, you got to do your homework, or you're going to have somebody in your corner that you can trust. Seek help. And so, an investment in knowledge always pays you the best interest. That's what Ben Franklin once said. And so you're going to have to do your homework, and you're going to have to try to seek out what your risk tolerance is, and you're going to have to get in there. And I think that over time, between stocks and bonds, asset allocation is very important. And so if you look at your 401k versus where it was in September of 2008, you'll find that chances are, if you were in the stock market, you're back to where you, if you're not totally back, you're back to where you, back to where you were.
So you have a basically optimistic approach to all this.
I sure do. And, for the folks out there that are not in plans, you have IRAs out there, these are all
right.
Retirement vehicles. You have Roth IRA. And so one is, you get the tax benefit now up front. Roth IRA, you get the benefit on the back end. And so even if you're not familiar with these different alternatives, that's when you seek the help. You may want to do your homework first. I like a book. It's called Investing Basics from Mark Robinson. And that particular book, it only costs – it costs less than $10,
mm-hmm.
and it tells you, it gets the ball rolling, and gets you thinking about the different investment tools or alternatives that are out there.
You've given us a lot of food for thought, Adrian Johnson. Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And all the information will be up on our website to check all that out. You've been listening to Your Money Matters, brought to you by MeQ. MeQ invests in yourself, and we'll invest in you. More information, call MeQ at 1-800-248-MECU or www.mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Professor Hubert Locke is speaking this week in Baltimore at the Institute of Christians and Jewish Studies. He's former provost emeritus of academic affairs and dean of the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington, Seattle. He's done many things, which we'll get into during the course of this hour, and written many books. One of his major works of the moment, and has been for many, many years, is A Christian Perspective on the Holocaust. And he joins us in our studios we work out of in Washington, D.C. today to bring a conversation to all of you. And Hubert Locke, welcome. It's a pleasure to meet you and have you in the studio.
Mr. Steiner, thank you very much.
So let's just begin, I think, where most people begin with you, I'm sure, and you probably have to answer this question ad nauseum.
I can anticipate it, in fact.
But as an African American, mm-hmm. as a Christian activist and leader and thinker in African American community and the American community, how did you come to be so taken with the issue of the Holocaust? Mm-hmm. How did that happen to you, for you?
I grew up in Detroit, and in 1955 went off to Divinity School to take my first degree toward becoming a Christian minister at the University of Chicago. And everything we read those days in theological studies were written by well-known and highly regarded German theologians, most of whom had been at the peak of their career during the Nazi era, many of whom were still alive, as a matter of fact, in 1955. And it's one of the reasons I never became a decent theologian, because I became far more interested as this young black kid from the ghetto of Detroit. I became far more interested in what these great German scholars were doing and saying about their own society when it was coming apart at the seams, rather than what they were writing theologically. So that awakened my interest in what was known at the time as the German church struggle, the oppositional movement within the German churches to National Socialism. And that question, of course, inevitably leads to the issue of where the churches stood with respect to the steadily declining status and ultimately the fate of Jewish citizens, both in Germany and ultimately throughout Europe.
But as a as you just self-described, I mean, as a – and I've read a bit about your past. As a young kid, a young man who grew up with parents, your father worked in the auto plants. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You grew up in the heart of the time of segregation.
Yes. Detroit was considered one of the most, if not the most, segregated city in the North.
In the North. Mm-hmm. And you obviously – very bright, had great promise, and being able to come out of that and going to university and going to graduate school. But it was also a time of very ferment within inside the black world of fighting to end segregation and the civil rights movement, which is why it was all the more interesting for many people to ponder, given all that, and what opposition you might have faced and even questions you might have faced as mm-hmm. a young man saying, this is the area that I'm interested in mm-hmm. studying. Mm-hmm.
One had to acknowledge, at least as I did during that period, the fate of another minority, and a fate far worse than anything we were facing in the United States. And of course, the question for me was, if this happened once before, could it happen again?
Right.
Might that have been the fate of my own people if we had been in Germany during that period? Or is it possible that here in the United States things could turn so ugly that a similar effort might be launched here in this country. And if one thinks about how vicious and brutal the reaction of the South was 10 years later, 10 years after this period that we're discussing, to the unfolding civil rights struggle in this country, the United States, thank God, didn't move in the direction of genocide, but that doesn't mean there were not a whole lot of people in the South who might well have welcomed such a policy.
Sometimes I worry we may not be too far from it now.
Yeah.
We can talk about that in a little bit.
Indeed.
But one of the things I found interesting in your approach to the Holocaust, and your book Learning from History, A Black Christian's Perspective on the Holocaust, is that you take some really interesting kind of views that other people have not. I mean, you talk about that era and the contradictions in that era from the Christians who stood up, mm-hmm. risked life and limb mm-hmm. to oppose the Third Reich, mm-hmm. but also the silence and the complicity from the other side. There's a quote you have in one of the pieces that you wrote where you talk about a French pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote is this: who was involved in the French resistance and in the rescue of Jews. And you wrote, there is a certain absolutism among younger generation today who cannot recapture the climate that reigned at the time. It was a climate of terror of the mind that affected all attitudes and moral positions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that seems in some way is how you approach looking at that moment.
Absolutely. I think there's a tendency, Mr. Steinert, to want to paint that entire period in far too stark a set of terms, to try to look for absolute heroes and unmitigated monsters. When what one sees, once one gets beyond the obvious villains in this whole business, the Hitlers, the Goebbels, the Goerings, the Himmlers, etc. Mm-hmm. What one sees are shades of gray everywhere. There were very few genuine martyrs, to use a good Christian term, in this period. Very few real heroes. Those in what we call the church struggle that we tend to admire are nevertheless people who have some sentiments that lead us to cringe a bit. I spent this morning looking at the monumental volume that's just been published of the letters and papers from prison of Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
All right.
Bonhoeffer was executed in 1945 for his role in the July 2044 plot on Hitler's life. There cannot be a more heroic figure with respect to this whole issue of opposition to the Nazi regime. Bonhoeffer was one of the few who challenged even the oppositional movement within the German churches about their lack of attention to the Jewish question. And yet if you probe Bonhoeffer's theological outlook, he was what we would call, if you'll forgive the theological language, a supersessionist. He thought that Christianity was here to replace Judaism, was the next step up the theological ladder, if mm-hmm. you will, and that it was the task of the church to try to convert Jews to the true faith. Today, that position is generally held only in very conservative religious circles. Among most mainstream Christian denominations, Judaism is looked at as an authentic faith within its own right. Most Christians feel that the covenant God has with the Jews has not been abrogated by the advent of Christianity. But that was a widely held belief in that period, even by people who risked their lives to try to save Jews. The Propst Gruber, who is one of the renowned figures of that period, his record in trying to help Jews escape Germany is almost unparalleled, and yet Richard Rubinstein, a well-known Jewish theologian, has a conversation with him in the post-war period in which Gruber is quite open about the fact that he still thinks the ultimate task for the church is to try to save Jews from their own Jewishness.
Save them the ovens first, then we'll save them from their Jewishness.
Yeah, exactly. So, unfortunately, that's a part of the picture that we have to acknowledge.
But you also, in the vast things that you've spoken about and written over the years, a couple things came to my mind as you were speaking. A, you've talked about that contradiction of Christians towards Jews is as old as the beginning of Christianity as a Jewish sect.
Yes, exactly.
That undercurrent continues to bubble even if it's not the preeminent thinking of the moment.
That's right.
Fuels it in some ways.
That's correct. And in my mind, not everyone agrees with this, to be sure, but in my mind, that distinction still has to be made. There is 2,000 years of religious antipathy on the part of Christians toward Judaism that I think has to be discussed as distinct from 2,000 years of Christian anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there has been an ongoing religious quarrel, if you will, between Jews and Christians that's not going to go away.
Right.
And we need to face up to that and acknowledge that and then go on to say, but that's absolutely no reason why Christian individuals or Christian groups should hold Jews as people in contempt or in disdain. Those are the distinctions I've tried to make.
And I wonder, when you talked about that we don't look at the Holocaust as in a gray matter, as all the contradictions exist and not just clearly black and white. Growing up as a young black man in America, looking at segregation, and before we went in the air, we talked about Tea Parties and where those people are today and who they are in America, mm-hmm. and what that means. Mm-hmm. Do you see the same gray matter here?
In what respect?
In that same respect, in terms of the feelings of racism and segregation and supremacy and the fear of the future. Do you see that same gray?
Yes. I think, to be very honest, one has to acknowledge it also. It's a very gray area. The outright unregenerate bigots in this world, I think, are a dying breed, thanks be to God. But the fact that I think large numbers of people on both sides of the racial divide hold ambivalent feelings about the other is just a part of the picture that we face and that we have to deal with. And the challenge is always how to keep that ambivalence within decent bounds, within civilized, within a range of civility.
We're talking with Professor Hubert Locke. He's Professor, Provost Emeritus for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington, Seattle, longtime civil rights activist, minister. A while back. He is here in the D.C. Baltimore area to speak at the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies and joins us in our studios that we work in Washington at Clean Cuts Music and Sound. He's the author of Learning from History, A Black Christian's Perspective on the Holocaust, and books like Searching for God in God-Forsaken Times and Places. One of the men that I really was not familiar with until I started thinking about talking to you, which you've written books about, a book about, was Martin Niemöller. Niemöller. Mm-hmm. Talk a bit about him and the contradiction of this human being and how he was so central to this and why he grabbed you as a theologian and thinker to kind of focus on.
He is a perfect example, Mr. Steiner, of the ambiguousness that we were talking about earlier. Niemöller begins his life and career not as a clergyman but as a German naval officer. During the First World War, he was a U-boat commander and, in fact, published his biography some years later under the title From U-boat to Consul, to Pulpit. And that's the progression of his career. After the war, he sort of finds himself religiously. He goes off to study theology and ends up as pastor of, in 1933, of a very affluent parish in a suburb of Berlin, Berlin-Dahlem. He is there when Hitler comes to power in 1933 and is one of those German pastors, one of the many German pastors who celebrates the rise of Adolf Hitler, who thinks that the National Socialists will bring some stability and some order to German society, but quickly falls out with the German, with the Nazi regime. By the fall of 1933, in fact, Niemöller is heading an effort to organize German pastors to offer some resistance to the National Socialists. Just very quickly, without trying to detail the next 12 years, he ends up more and more as an outspoken opponent, a public outspoken opponent of German National Socialism, is arrested in 1936, I believe, 36 or 37, held for 8 months, finally brought to trial because Niemöller by this time is well known in circles outside of Germany. There's a lot of political pressure to try him and free him. He is tried. He is, in fact, although he's found guilty, he's sentenced to the time he's already served in jail at that time, released, but rearrested by the Gestapo, taken first to Sachsenhausen, the concentration camp at Sachsenhausen, and ultimately to Dachau, where he spent the entire war period. Is miraculously released by the Allies when they invade Europe, and after the war becomes one of the most outstanding churchmen, becomes one of the first presidents, in fact, of the World Council of Churches. Niemöller, for me, has always been a symbol, Mr. Steiner, of this, how best to describe it, this human dimension of this whole trauma. Because here he starts out as an enthusiastic supporter of mm-hmm. Hitler and the German regime, the National Socialist regime, but becomes increasingly disillusioned with it and finally becomes one of its most outstanding opponents. And I think that's a fairly good reflection of what most of the people that we're going to encounter in this period were like. You know, they were not purists. They right. didn't start out at the outset, you know, with a clear vision of how horrid all of this business is. And forgive this lengthy answer.
No, that's fine.
if I could just add one other thing. Many people want to treat the Holocaust and German National Socialism as though German citizens should have known at the very outset, from day one, how bad it was all going to be. The actual process of trying to annihilate the Jews of Europe did not begin, we have to constantly remind ourselves, until the early 1940s. It didn't begin in 1933. What began in 1933 was a process of labeling and treating Jewish citizens as second-class citizens, of stripping their rights and protections under the German Constitution as citizens. And it's only gradually that even the Nazis themselves move toward a policy of annihilation. So we shouldn't find it surprising that people also move gradually in their response, in their antipathy, ultimately in, for those who did, in their absolute disdain for the Nazi regime.
The opposition to Adolf Hitler in the beginning and to the Third Reich and to the National Socialists actually came from the communists and socialists. And,
that's right.
And the left opposition to seeing what was coming, and that was where the focus was. The rest built up over time.
That's exactly right.
So a couple of things come to mind, and I just want to share something because Martin Niemöller is the person who said this. Now let me just read it, mm-hmm. the famous statement. Mm-hmm. They came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up. I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Mm-hmm. Then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak up.
Exactly.
And so that wasn't just – it's a statement that stays with history. Mm-hmm. I mean, the words have changed by many people, but stayed mm-hmm. with history. But what's interesting, when I realized this was the same Niemöller that you wrote about, mm-hmm. was he was telling the truth. That's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. That they started coming out of the communists, they came after the Jews, nobody spoke up, and literally when they came after him, there was nobody left to speak
That's right.
up.
Exactly.
Literally.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it wasn't some euphemistic philosophical statement he's making. This is a statement in fact that he's talking about.
Thank you very much for quoting it accurately in the first instance, because it's a statement that is so well known now that it's been embellished by all sorts of groups. You know, I've heard it. It came for the Catholics. Well, unfortunately, Martin Niemöller was not a great friend of his Roman Catholic brethren, so he would never have mentioned them. I've heard the gays added to it, etc. And although gays and lesbians suffered under National Socialism, to be sure, Martin Niemöller did not come to their defense either. But it is a chronological statement of what happened in Germany with respect to the groups that you mentioned. And so it is quite correct that by 1937, when the Gestapo rearrested him, there was no one left to speak out.
So a couple of things pop up in my head before we move on to another area about Martin Niemöller and you're thinking about the Holocaust. Because this really, I think you touched on it a moment ago, that Martin Niemöller's life for you embodies the struggle that Christians had mm-hmm. and that Christianity had in Europe mm-hmm. during the war and during the Holocaust. I mean, he's emblematic mm-hmm. of all of that for you, mm-hmm. which is why you focused on him.
That's right. That's right. Very much so. There are several other people now who emerge who I think are equally emblematic of what was going on. One is the French pastor, André Trocmé, the pastor of the little village of Les Chambons, a village of French Huguenots that's credited with saving upwards of 5,000 French Jews who were hidden in the village, were helped to get over the Alps to Switzerland or sometimes into Spain, otherwise certainly to get out of occupied France. And he too is a heroic figure of almost superhuman dimension. His daughter lives in Minneapolis, as a matter of fact, and his granddaughter lives in my town of Seattle. So there are still close personal connections that I feel with André Trocmé. But here, too, you see an evolution of his thought, not as dramatic as that of Niemöller, to be sure. Here's a French pastor who knows what persecution is all about as a French Huguenot. And so when the when he's presented with other persecuted people, people who are being persecuted for their religious beliefs, his response is almost immediate to come to their rescue. I am interested in these figures. I became interested in these people because they presented to me, and I think they present first to every Christian and ultimately to every individual, the simple question, what would I do if I found myself in those circumstances? How would I respond? And I can only say, Mr. Steiner, I've long cautioned myself at age 76 now, and thus would caution others, don't try to answer that question too quickly.
On that note, we're going to take a very brief break. We're talking with Professor Hubert Locke, Provost Emeritus for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington, Seattle. He's one of the leading thinkers and writers about issues of the Holocaust, especially the Christian response to the Holocaust. His books are Learning from History, A Black Christian's Perspective on the Holocaust, and Searching for God in God-Forsaken Times and Places. We'll continue our conversation when we return. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're with Professor Hubert Locke, Vice Provost Emeritus for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington, Seattle, one of our nation's and the world's leading thinkers on the Holocaust. He's written many books, but two of the books we're talking about, Learning from History, A Black Christian's Perspective on the Holocaust, and Searching for God in God-Forsaken Times and Places. I'm interested in two things here. A, why it is important as a black Christian to talk about black Christian perspective, A, on the Holocaust, and B, in general, just what you think needs to be wrestled with as a Christian perspective on the Holocaust.
As a black Christian, of course, I'm interested in my own status, quite selfishly, but also the status of my people as a minority in American society. And even though for some we've entered a post-racial era in this country, I think that's frightfully premature. And
unfortunately, I think you're correct.
Yes. And thus, the kinds of questions that emerge out of the experience of Germany in the 1930s, I think, are still very relevant for American society in the first decade of the 21st century. But the larger question for the Christian community as a whole arises out of the fact, for me, that this is the one institution, that the churches, if you will, the one institution in German society where one would have hoped for a resounding moral response to the Nazi policies concerning the Jews. One must note quickly that this was not coming from any other institutional source within German society where one might have hoped for this. Certainly did not come from the courts, did not come from the legal profession, did not come especially, Mark, from the universities. And that's been the other
piece.
Hat that I've
right.
worn
right.
Throughout my career. And if one wants to be critical of the churches, one can be critical by a magnitude of 10 of the universities that really knuckled, not only knuckled under to National Socialism, but became enthusiastic bulwarks in many instances of Nazi ideology. So for me, the lesson always is what in society, where in society can we look for sources of resistance to policies of the state that are oppressive, that are tyrannical? And one, in at least in my small judgment, always hopes that the church will be in the vanguard, will be in the forefront of those efforts. It was not the case, unfortunately, in Germany. We can be grateful in this country that during the civil rights era, it was the churches who were in the vanguard.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that will always happen. just to add a quick note, if you look at the wider scene in Europe during the Nazi era, one of the countries that has a rather decent record with respect to this whole question of the Holocaust is Bulgaria, of all places.
Right.
And there it was, the metropolitan of Bulgaria and the Bulgarian king at the time.
Orthodox Christians.
The Orthodox Christians, indeed, but who were rather courageous in their resistance of the Nazi onslaught. And as a result, far fewer Bulgarian Jews perished than elsewhere in Eastern Europe.
And even though the Catholic Church did not stand up to the Nazis, the Roman Catholic Church, and the Pope did not then, I've been reading a lot about a lot of individual priests in the Italian resistance who did a lot to save Jews during that war as well.
Absolutely. Yes. I in fact, think one has to say that while the record of Pius XII is tragically ambiguous on this question, there are others during that period in the Catholic Church whose record is much clearer and much more positive. That of Pope John XXIII being one such example. He was outspoken in his insistence that the Church ought to take a stance on this.
He was a very special human being, Pope John XXIII.
Yes, he was indeed. Yes, he was.
I still – one of my first presents when I moved to my apartment from my now fiancé was a picture of Pope John XXIII. Just
– Really?
Yeah, just because I just loved and admired him so much.
There's a story, not apropos of anything we're discussing, but it's my favorite story of John XXIII. He is said to have been walking through the Vatican Gardens one fine day, and a gardener there, just overwhelmed with emotion, rushed up and grabbed his hand and knelt and kissed it. And the papal guards, of course, came up and grabbed the gardener and started to drag him away. And Pope John is said to have said, "What's the matter? I wasn't going to hurt him."
That's right. I like that. That says a lot about who that human being was to us all. I came across some other people in kind of preparing to meet you today. People like Elizabeth Schmitz, who I never knew existed before. I started thinking about our interview. An incredible Christian woman in Germany who stood up to the Nazis. Mm-hmm. It was part of Bonhoeffer's confessing church, which I really wasn't aware of that much, too deeply. Talk a bit about that group and what that was.
The confessing church was part of this effort that sprang up really in the fall of 1933, 6-7 months after the Nazis came to power. And it arose initially over the question of whether the church would enforce in its ranks what was called the Arian paragraph. April 1933, the Nazi government passed what they called the Civil Service Act, which dismissed from the German civil service everyone who was not a certifiably Arian, which, of course, wiped out all the German judges, the German professors in the universities, etc. All were dismissed from their posts. A debate arose within the German church whether it ought to adopt a similar policy, a policy, incidentally, Mark, that would have affected only about 150 of Germany's 18,000 Protestant pastors. These were men who had some Jewish ancestry. That precipitated this intense tug of war within the churches between those who said that's absolute nonsense that we should be asked to enforce such a policy, and those who said, no, we must do this to show our support for the Nazi regime. The latter group became known as the Deutsche Christen, the German Christians. the group in opposition became known as the Confessing Church. Mm-hmm. And that was the group that in 1934, April 1934, that is the Confessing Church, issued at one of its synod meetings, one of its church councils, issued a very famed declaration called the Barmen Declaration, so named for the town in which they met to hold their synod. That was probably the clearest, most unequivocal statement of opposition to the Nazi regime, and the theological, biblical and theological reasons for that opposition. Unfortunately, it's a statement that makes no mention of the Jews and the plight of the Jews. It can be hailed as a clear and unequivocal statement of the reasons for the church's opposition to the Nazi regime, but in this sense, the church looking out for its own well-being and not seeing the larger issues that were at stake.
And it's an amazing piece of the history that I really had not focused on until now, and also the woman who I mentioned, Elizabeth Schmitz, and her statement to that group in 1936 was just, let me just read it because I was just so taken with it, just for our audience. How are we to answer the many desperate, bitter questions and complaints? Why doesn't the church do anything? Why does it permit the nameless injustices to go on? How can it time and again pay joyous tribute to the National Socialists and offer political endorsements to a government that persecutes some of its own members? Why does it not at least protect the children? How could it be that everything that is simply incompatible with the nowadays much maligned humanness could be compatible with Christianity?
Yeah. Thank goodness we have the statements such as that of Frau Schmidt to look back upon, and they enable us to say not everybody knuckled under. The problem, there just weren't enough such people.
Well, maybe that's always the problem. That's why I'm going to come to where we are now in some ways. I mean, you... I'm pulling out a lot of the little things that you wrote, just little statements just to throw some conversation pieces here. And you actually answered this question directly at the beginning of our conversation. But in Chapter 9 of your book, A Black Christian's Perspective on the Holocaust, Learning from History, in the beginning of one of the chapters you write, how is it possible, it is asked, that German citizens could claim they were unaware of the Holocaust? How could they watch their Jewish neighbors being rounded up and herded into trucks or marched to the railway depots and loaded into cattle cars, bound, never seen or heard from again? By what enormous self-deception could an entire nation of people not know the fate of minority populace in its midst? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And earlier you talked about how many people didn't see it and the shades of gray and that it didn't really come to the fore till later, and the Jews really weren't carted away till later, but things were developing. Well, things always develop in every society. You see bubbling up, and we'll come back maybe a little bit too, but you've written about Rwanda, and you've written about many other places, but you focused a lot of time in your life in Rwanda. But I'm thinking about here. Mm-hmm. When do we feel and know that bubbling up is happening? Can human beings know? Can we look at Arizona and watch legislation being passed in Arizona that targets every Latino human being that lives, or any person who's of a brown hue, whether a Native American or Latino, whoever they might be, mixed race, and go, oh, we're going to stop this person. How can we know when the bubbling up is beginning? Yeah. Or can we?
We see what we want to see, Mark. Part of the problem lies in that simple fact. We look at Arizona and we say, oh, my God. But then we say, but that's Arizona, you know.
Right.
And we find all sorts of reasons to dismiss that. We look at the Texas Board of Education rewriting the history of the United States. And we say, well, it's those nuts in Texas. But we do not see these as very clear warning signs about which we ought to act. You know, if every other school district in the United States were to stand up at this point and say, fine, you sell those textbooks and say to the publishers, sell them in Texas, but you won't sell them in New Jersey or in Kansas or in California, then we would put a stop to this nonsense. And if in the case of Arizona, which is so dependent on the tourist industry, people would across the nation would simply say, well, that's a spot I'm not going to set foot in until those people show themselves to be more decent and civilized Americans, we would begin to call a halt to these kinds of things. But everyone, not everyone, thank God, but most people are inclined to want to treat these as aberrations, as one-time events, as exceptions to the general rule of sanity and civility in the society. And that's, at least in German terms, what happened is that what was viewed in the late 1920s as and early 30s as an aberration became the norm.
And you just used the word civility. Mm-hmm. And you clearly are a very civil human being, a man full of civility in your manner and your demeanor and the way you speak, and it comes out of your essence. It just feels it across the table. And I say that not to butter you up or to say wonderful things about Professor Hubert Locke, but because
– to embarrass me.
But I worry that we spend so much time worrying about civility and being civil sometimes. Not that I don't think we should be. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be full of hate. But we spend so much time talking about civility that we lose sight of the issues and what's in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point, Mark. I tend to think of civility in its old original Latin context as the kind of urban spirit, the spirit of responsibility for the commonweal, the responsibility for the larger society. And I think of a person who tries to be civil as a person who has that larger sense of responsibility. But you are quite right, sir, to point out that many times we can, in our efforts to be civil, often fail to be courageous. And clearly that's what the times in our own society call for.
So I most one of those who kind of wants to contemplate, as we've been doing the last few minutes here, what history teaches us, what we learn from it, how we use it for what comes next. People always ask, will the genocide ever end in the world? And we've come through 100 years, a century, where genocide has happened more than once. At least we're wholly aware of it. I mean, yeah, blood was spilled in the streets in the Crusades when thousands of Muslims and Jews were slaughtered by the Christian Crusades, and back and forth through time we've seen this happen. But there's something about this modern era. Maybe it's because we're more aware of it. Maybe because technology makes us – because we see the pictures. We see the photographs, and they're embedded in our minds. But it really keeps raising the question, can we end it? Can we end the thing that you spend your life studying, talking, and thinking about?
For my small part, Mark, if I didn't believe we could end it, I would – turn my attention to other kinds of issues and problems, dilemmas. I think it can be, although the record in that regard is not very encouraging. But I think we have to keep at it. In fact, it brings to mind for me what I recall one of my mentors saying when I was much younger and much more inclined to get wrought up, as the saying goes, and as a result to become deeply discouraged by developments in the civil rights struggle. This is the era prior to 1955. And I asked my mentor, who had been involved in it, Lord knows, for much longer than I had, I said, why do you keep at it? It looks like we're not getting anywhere. I said, I don't think we're winning this battle. He says, that's not the question. He said, we stay at it because it's the right thing to do, and it's the only thing we can do. And I've come to feel that way about the genocide issue and about a number of other issues as well. We have to stay at it because it's the only thing as decent human beings we can do. It's the right thing to do, whether we win it or not.
Going back into a bit of history, one of the things you acknowledge in your book that many people have not in terms of studying the Holocaust, and I think it, for me, as someone who was raised Jewish, who grew up with people in their living room with numbers in their arms, we always forget, we seem to forget, and within the Jewish community is a big argument about this, is the other 5 million who died in those camps, who were not Jews. You mentioned them, the Romanis, the Gypsies, that they truly tried to annihilate and destroy as a people. Gays, socialists, communists, opposition people, Christians who didn't agree.
The Polish.
2.5 million Poles. 2.5 million Polish people were killed in those camps.
That's right.
And I don't think we can be allowed to forget that as well as we keep looking at the other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In Holocaust studies, we've tried rather carefully in answering the question, why is the Holocaust to be considered unique? We've tried to say that the policy for extermination of the Jews, in a sense, was sui generis. They were the group targeted as a so-called race to be wiped off the face of the earth. What the Nazis did with equal viciousness, to be sure, was to say there are, while we're at it, there are a number of other undesirables that we ought to rid ourselves of, including the socially undesirables, the gay and lesbian community, and the culturally undesirables, the Romani and Sinti people, and the Polish intellectuals, because they were a threat, the possible source of resistance and opposition. But the targeting of the Jews in this sense was unique, and it brings us back again to my own lifetime preoccupation with that experience, because I must constantly ask myself if it happened once before with respect to a, quote, racial minority in a cultured, civilized, technologically proficient, scientifically
advanced
nation. If it happened once before, could it happen again? And this time around, might it not be the Jews, but might it be me and my folk?
And so in the end, one of the lessons you learn, you're imparting on the world, is we have to stay vigilant and awake here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We've been talking with Professor Hubert Locke, Vice Provost Emeritus for Academic Affairs and Dean of Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington, Seattle. His book, books, many books, but two of them we've been talking about, Learning from History, A Black Christian's Perspective on the Holocaust and Searching for God in God-Forsaken Times and Places. He's in the Baltimore, Washington area to speak at the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies and has joined us in the studios we use in Washington, D.C. at Clean Cuts Music and Sound. Professor Hubert Locke, it's been a pleasure to have you in the studio and to meet you. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com.